Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we will be talking with Dr. Spencer Dorn, Vice Chief of Gastroenterology at UNC's Center for Functional GI and Motility Disorders, about a topic that lots of people might be interested in, constipation. We'll talk about causes, prevention, and treatment.
Yeah, Christy, this is one of those things that we're not going to ask each other if you've experienced it in the last 24 hours.
Most people have,
and this is such an important issue, and I'm really excited to talk with one of the experts who actually helped develop national guidelines.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that conversation. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about a link between parents' depression and toddlers in trouble.
We're going to talk about whether or not you get weighed daily. Can that actually help you lose weight?
About websites selling genetic cancer tests.
And then one of the first research that looks at a common and growing problem, which is advertising for electronic cigarettes linked to increased use of electronic cigarettes?
Mm-hmm. Let's get started. Okay, first of all, we're going to talk about a link between depression and behaviors in toddlers. And so we know, and we've talked before about this problem of postpartum depression that affects many women after having a baby or around the time of that big transition. But this also looking a little bit at father's depression.
Yeah, what about the men here? Can't we have postpartum depression? I mean, I think that we do, but I've never really thought about the question they're asking here. And this was actually in an online journal called Couple and Family Psychology Research and Practice. Love the name of the journal. Love this research. What was it about?
So this was about this link between a father's depression in the first years of parenting, as well as a mother's, and a link between toddler being at higher risk of developing troubling behaviors like hitting, lying, anxiety, sadness during times of development.
Yeah, this was 200 couples with three-year-olds, and they had been followed over a period of time and looking at a depression study around the time of their birth. And it turns out that, yes, both a history of depression among both the mother and the father during this critical period of birth to development were each associated with how the child took in these types of behaviors and then what they kind of acting out sorts of things. And this was important, and I think for me says, I better start asking about and thinking about both how's the father doing as well
right.
as the mother.
I mean, we talk a lot about the mother-baby dyad, and certainly in family medicine, we're able to take care of both the mom and the baby as our patient. And we take care of dads, too. So this really does, I think, change our lens a little bit to think about the whole family's wellness and impact on those dynamics.
Yeah, we know one of the things that I really found interesting, and we'll move on, is that the fighting between the parents didn't seem to have as much of an impact on the child's kind of acting out behavior as having a depressed parent. Hmm. Both are important, but let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. We really have to focus in on the depression. That was probably a bad analogy to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I don't think we want to throw anyone here. But let's move on and let's throw out the next research that matters.
Okay. I don't think so. Okay. This is about daily weigh-ins. So, you know, sometimes when you're losing weight, people tell you to weigh yourself every day at the same time. I think a lot of people do that. And other people say, no, don't weigh yourself very often. Only do it once a week or once every few weeks so you can see bigger impact.
This was research that was done at one of our sister universities down the street called Duke University, and it was published in the Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And it was a very interesting study of close to 100 people who were really pretty healthy, but they were needing to lose weight because they were in the overweight or obese. And half were given into this group where they filled out questionnaires, diets, and they were given ways to measure their weight to then look at progress and given some weekly emails. And the other half didn't get that weekly weigh-in sort of thing they were supposed to do.
Yeah, so the intervention group got those weekly emails and were told to weigh themselves every day and record it. And the other group didn't. And what they found were that the people, after 6 months, the daily weighers in the intervention group lost 13 to 14 pounds, while those who weighed themselves 5 days or fewer each week lost about 7 pounds.
You know, it's interesting, Christy. This is really a pretty dramatic effect in the type of research that when we follow this type of weight loss interventions in a fairly simple one, and perhaps even counterintuitive. We would think, oh, yeah, people, if they weigh themselves, they lose more weight. But we've seen other research that says maybe that is not as effective as just focusing on changing your behavior. But here it says, in a pretty rigorous at least start, it may be effective.
Well, I think for a lot of people, writing down what you eat every day can make a difference, and weighing yourself and starting to see links between those behavior changes and that trend starting to stabilize or go down in the down direction in your weight can reinforce those behavior changes. So it makes sense to me that this would work.
Now, Christy, you and I think perhaps have optimal weights. And I'm going to say, and we'll see, do you ever weigh yourself every day? Is this something that a woman does? I mean, I know that actually I do weigh myself every day because my weight can fluctuate. And I see when my weight goes up, I actually probably eat a little bit less for a couple of days. I don't think I consciously think about it, but I think that's what happens and keeps my weight in a pretty narrow range. I don't know if that's what most people do.
Yeah, I do better when I'm weighing myself every day. And I have, on the whole, over the last decade, been pretty much a daily weigher. But lately, I've been adding on muscle mass, and so my weight's going up a little, so I've stopped getting on the scale and going more on how I feel and how I fit in my clothes.
Well, you look great.
Thanks.
And you feel healthy. So talk about this next research that matters, which is getting genetic cancer tests and the websites that are selling these tests. Is the information accurate on these websites?
So, I mean, this is a little bit, it's one of those trendy things and a little bit scary, too. A lot of people feel like getting tests and knowing information is a good thing, and they're willing to spend a lot of money and do tests outside of the doctor's office because they feel like, oh, there's a test to see about this cancer link, and I should have that test. But what we know is that many sites offer tests that are not proven to be useful to guide cancer treatment or prevention or have any information that's actually helpful to a person, which, you know, might be expensive and not helpful and maybe harmful.
Right. So this was a study that was published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, and they analyzed 55 websites that were offering these genetic tests. And they basically found that these websites tended to overstate the supposed benefits and downplayed the limitations, and that 88% of the websites offered non-standard tests that lacked evidence of these really providing benefits. And I think this gives me a whoa, a lot of caution here. You know, you're going to have to be able to analyze the website or get accurate information. And perhaps we can ask our health science librarians to help us come up with some ways of better analyzing some of these websites and getting more accurate information when you are interested in finding out information about genetic testing, and ask our genetic departments as well.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Our health sciences librarians are experts in knowing which websites are credible and are not. So let's have you guys put something up for us. That's a great idea.
Our last research that matters, Christy, is an article that was published in the journal Health Communication, actually from a colleague, Dr. Joseph Capella, up at Annenberg School for Communication, about looking at electronic cigarette advertising and how it may be related to increasing people's urge to use electronic cigarettes.
So what they did was they assessed the urge to smoke among about 300 daily smokers, along with about 272 intermittent smokers and 311 former smokers. So they had a group of daily smokers, intermittent smokers, and former smokers.
And these folks looked at e-cigarette commercials that showed vaping and some did not. And then they were, before and after they looked at them, they were asked about urges to smoke. And basically, they showed that those who were daily smokers who saw these ads had a greater desire to smoke and a higher likelihood of doing so. And then those who were former smokers were more likely to report actually that they might not abstain from smoking. And so this is a worrisome aspect. It mirrors what we see with regular cigarettes and advertising. And I think this is just going to be one of many research that ultimately leads to the Food and Drug Administration actually regulating e-cigarettes, which is probably a good thing because right now it's still the wild, wild west.
Well, I want you to comment on that. I know you're an expert in this field. Why is vaping or these e-cigarettes, what is bad about them?
Well, first off, we don't know if they're safe. Second off, we don't really know if they're effective in terms of helping people quit. We don't have that long-term data. The people's opinions are much stronger than the data. And the problem is here is if the folks who have quit smoking and are off cigarettes entirely are getting enticed back into them potentially through these advertisements, that's not a good thing. For those who are less – who are maybe trying to quit, they may already be using them. And if they've cut down and quit, that would be a good thing. But what we see is a lot of times it's smoking and using electronic cigarettes. So the real question finally is about kids. Does this practice encourage kids to end up using these types of products? We don't – this data doesn't show this, but that's the big concern. That's Pandora's box. That's the pot of gold. If it does – regulations will come quickly.
You know, Adam, I'm going to have you as an expert on our show sometime soon to talk about this.
Would love it,
Would love to interview you.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Spencer Dorn at the University of North Carolina about constipation causes, prevention, and treatment. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Spencer Dorn, Vice Chief of Gastroenterology at the University of North Carolina's Center for Functional Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, about constipation, causes, prevention, and treatment.
Welcome, Dr. Dorn. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what sparked your interest in gastroenterology, in particular, like motility disorders or disorders of how that system works?
Well, that's a good question. It's not always a popular choice. I guess I'd say a few things. One is I always wanted to take care of patients, so I wanted a job in medicine that involved direct patient care. And though I initially thought I wanted to be a pediatrician, I learned I wanted to work more with sick adults, so I chose internal medicine. And then I still want to be a specialist. Unlike you guys, you do family medicine, you're good at everything. I want to focus in on more specific areas. And I liked gastroenterology because it is still a blend of many different organs. We do procedural work, endoscopies and other types of tests. We do office-based work. We do inpatient, outpatient, chronic and acute care. So it seemed like a nice balance of many different areas that would keep my interest. In terms of why I specifically homed in on functional GI disorders, well, I guess that would go back to my residency. I got involved in some research opportunities, and I realized that these conditions were exceedingly common. We'll talk more about that probably in a little while. And patients with these conditions are generally underserved. There seemed to be a nice opportunity for research. And what I really liked about it is the opportunity to really make a difference in someone's lives, because if you're suffering from one of these conditions, you generally know it, you feel it, and you could directly relieve symptoms as opposed to something like diabetes or high blood pressure, where someone generally is asymptomatic until there are possible complications. So I really liked that aspect of gastroenterology, the fact that the opportunity to directly relieve symptoms.
You know, I'm thinking about, as you're talking, that virtually, you know, all of our days are in part consumed by eating and drinking and the social aspect of that. And also the other images that my I used to hear from my grandparents, well, you wait till you're our age and you'll, you know, your a lot of your conversation actually is about eating and drinking and things like constipation. But you know, I recognize as a family doctor that this is a pervasive problem that of so many people across the age spectrum. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by functional disorders, but also about constipation specifically, because that is such a critical problem.
Sure, sure. So broadly speaking, in medicine, there are two main types of problems. They're what we call functional problems and structural problems. Structural is also sometimes called organic, and a structural problem is like a broken bone. You could see it on an X-ray. You could see it with different types of tests. Another example would be an ulcer, something that's structurally abnormal with the way the body is hooked up, and that therefore leads to physical symptoms. symptoms. In contradistinction, there's what we call functional disorders. And there are many different types of functional disorders that affect different parts of the body. And these are conditions characterized by symptoms without overt pathology, meaning back pain without any abnormalities on an MRI, or headaches without any abnormalities on a CAT scan of the brain, or abdominal pain without any abnormalities on an upper or lower endoscopy.
But these are real. This is not these pain is real. This is not imaginary pain.
Right. So these conditions are quite real, and in some cases they're more disabling than structural conditions. They affect a whole host of people and a wide variety of different types of organ systems. For instance, fibromyalgia, chronic musculoskeletal pain without any overt pathology, migraine headaches, as we mentioned, chronic pelvic pain, TMJ. There's really a whole long laundry list of these conditions. Of these conditions, there's a group that affect the gastrointestinal tract. The most common functional gastrointestinal disorder is irritable bowel syndrome, nicknamed IBS. But there are a bunch of others, including functional dyspepsia, functional abdominal pain syndrome, and of course, what I'm here to talk to you today about, chronic constipation.
Let's talk about constipation, because it seems like, you know, everybody feels like they've been constipated at one time or another, and then there are a lot of differences and expectations about how often someone should have a bowel movement. So what exactly is constipation?
Right. So everyone has probably been constipated at some point in their lives. Some people chronically so, some people only for maybe a short time. Constipation is defined differently. And in fact, we as physicians tend to define constipation differently than patients do. Mm-hmm. A survey done here at UNC in the 1980s involved asking a bunch of students what they consider constipation. And what the students coming out of student health considered constipation was having hard bowel movements or difficulty evacuating stool. The same research group then asked physicians, what do you consider constipations? And physicians tend to focus on the frequency of bowel movement. So physicians and patients tend to define constipation differently. But what I would say, and I would refer listeners to different guidelines if they're interested, but I would define constipation as being a combination of either infrequent stools, very hard stools, or difficult to expel stools. I think it's a combination of those three broad categories.
And are people do people really know if they have constipation? In other words, I'm thinking in part when a parent brings a child in sometimes, or even a teenager, and I try to have a conversation, and it's sometimes not so obvious that that's maybe going on. So how well do people really know what their bowel patterns are to be able to know whether or not this could be happening?
Right. Well, I think that most people are pretty aware of their bowel patterns, I would argue. Most people know when they're changing or causing them discomfort. I think constipation is largely in the eye of the beholder. Some patients or some people, they're not patients, could go a week without having a bowel movement. They feel completely normal. It's not a problem for them at all, and they live life normally. Other folks, you know, they go a day or two without having a bowel movement, or they have one hard stool, and they're very concerned about that. So I think constipation, unlike blood pressure or diabetes or lipid hypercholesterolemia, it really is defined based on symptoms that are meaningful to the patient. So I think that a patient who thinks they're constipated probably is, although I will say that some patients feel like they're constipated, yet they're having completely normal frequency of bowel movements, completely normal stool consistency. It's more of a perceptual issue.
Hmm. So help us understand for the majority of patients, both children and adults, what are the most common causes of constipation that lead someone to have this problem?
Right. Well, I'll refrain from speaking too much about children because although I'm a father, I am not a pediatrician.
And you
I'm
probably have more expertise, though, from
yeah.
that.
Right. So I don't want to speak too much, though. But yes, obviously there are some similarities between adults and children and elderly folks as well. So in terms of mechanisms for constipation, and by the way, let's take a step back because I know your listeners want to know what is the normal stool frequency. We consider normal stool frequency between three times a day and three times a week. If you're more or less, it does not necessarily mean there's a problem, but that's what, you know, is defined as quote-unquote
normal
through population-based studies.
That's pretty wide variation.
That is a wide variation. Yeah. Again, going back to why it's so hard to classify constipation, because it's mm-hmm. more in how much of an issue is it for the individual. But going back to your question, Christy, what is the main cause of constipation? Well, in some cases, we find that patients who are constipated are taking medications. There's a whole different host of medications that could cause constipation. And then sometimes we see constipation in patients who perhaps have relatively low fiber in their diet or different dietary patterns or extreme inactivity. But in general, there's usually not a single isolated cause of the constipation, so to speak. It's not that someone is doing something and that's what's leading to the constipation. I will say that if you talk about the mechanisms of constipation, why do people get constipated? And if you look at the underlying pathophysiology, meaning the way the body works, we know there are a few main mechanisms or pathways by which people develop constipation. The first is that some people, they just have what we call slow transit. Their colon takes a really long time to get the stool around. And the example I give there, it's suppose you're driving on I-40 during rush hour. There's a big traffic delay. Things are just moving very slowly through the gut. The second reason is what we call outlet obstruction. And what that is, its stool is actually getting to the rectum, which is the end of the colon, in an appropriate amount of time, but the person has a difficulty getting it out or evacuating it. And the example there is, you know, I-40 traffic's moving great. You get to the Chapel Hill exit, and there's a backup there. The third category is kind of a wastebasket category. We call it normal transit constipation. These are patients or other individuals who don't have any observed slow transit or any difficulty evacuating, yet they're still constipated. And this would be more of an irritable bowel syndrome type constipated pattern.
Well, Dr. Dorn, we do need to take a short break. I'm wondering how many people are in their cars right now listening to the show and picturing these images.
And we don't want them to go on the
highway.
Emergency ramp just to get off and around, though we may have to find out what maneuvers you do take.
Exactly. But we need to take a break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Spencer Dorn, Vice Chief of Gastroenterology at UNC's Center for Functional GI and Motility Disorders, about constipation, causes, prevention, and treatment. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Spencer Dorn of the University of North Carolina Center for Functional Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders about constipation causes, prevention, and treatment. And Dr. Dorn, right before the break, Christy kind of jokingly talked about in your analogy on the interstate in traffic. But on a serious note, it seems that a lot of patients talk about constipation when they travel. Tell us a little bit about how this fits into the kind of the mechanisms that you were talking about, and what type of advice do you give people in the society where everyone is traveling increasingly long distances about having to avoid this?
That's a great question. I think, you know, in the GI world, traveler's diarrhea gets a lot more publicity, you know, going to a maybe an underdeveloped country or traveling abroad, getting diarrhea because of changes in either a bacterial infection or just changes in the general diet. But I think, as you mentioned, Adam, traveler's constipation is really common. So why does it occur? I think there are several reasons why it occurs. First, when we travel, our circadian rhythms are off. Especially if we're traveling through different time zones. And the gut tends to work like on a clockwork type basis. You're most likely to have a bowel movement in the morning after eating breakfast. And if, you know, 8 o'clock in your body time is, 4 o'clock in the morning where you travel to and you're sleeping, you may miss those cues and that urge to go. Second, when we travel, we often alter our diets. And I don't know what you're like when you travel, but a lot of us fail to sit down and eat salads or high-fiber foods and instead tend to grab things like sandwiches or snack bars on the go that tend to be higher in fiber. And then lastly, I think that people don't like to use other public restrooms. And when you're traveling, you're away from your bathroom, you're away from your own home routine, and the lifestyle changes, I think, are more likely to lead to constipation. What do I recommend? I recommend, one, if you're only traveling for a short time, it's probably not going to be that big of a deal. But certainly, individuals should keep up with their fiber intake, Pay attention to the cues of when they have the urge to defecate. Another thing that could be helpful would be to take a laxative, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on, but either an osmotic laxative, a fiber supplement, or something along those lines, in case the traveler does not have a bowel movement for a couple of days and it's starting to bother them.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. So if someone's constipated, whether traveling or at home, and they Google some things, you might see, okay, increase your fluids, drink more water, take more fiber, eat more salads. People know to eat some prunes, and maybe take an over-the-counter stool softener or something that you can get at the pharmacy. I want to be sure we talk about laxatives, but also, when should a person seek medical care versus sort of try to handle it with those things on their own?
So answer to your question, I guess, in brief, is if they're worried about their condition. Like I said, many people are constipated. Most people who are constipated never see a doctor for it. They just manage it on their own. So mm-hmm. we don't need to over-medicalize what is probably a very normal human condition. But things that I would personally worry about are things like rectal bleeding or a dramatic change in bowel pattern in a short period of time. Family history of colon problems such as colon cancer, things like that. But in the absence of those symptoms that I would term red flags or alarm symptoms, I think it's really a matter of, you know, how bothersome are the symptoms. Mm-hmm. Is it getting in the way of your doing things, your quality of life? If it isn't, probably safe to manage it on your own.
Yeah, one of the things Christy mentioned, she kind of went through some things that I think are intuitive, but I don't necessarily think they're easy. So, for instance, let's say water. How much water do you recommend that people drink a day in order, and does that help with constipation? And the second thing I want to talk about is fiber. Could you give us some, maybe think about one or two patients you've had recently and some very specific recommendations of how you help people understand how much fiber they should be having?
Sure. So the first question about water, that's one of the great fallacies in medical education and probably in healthcare. Unless you are clinically dehydrated, increasing your water consumption does not increase your stool frequency. It's not going to treat constipation. So if you like drinking water,
I gotta change what I've said.
Well, but if you're taking a stool softener, don't you need to drink more water? No.
Well, in the stool softeners or fiber, maybe you need enough water to get it down. But unless you're clinic, the gut is the gut reabsorbs a ton of water every day. You think about all the fluid efflux into the gut, the amount of saliva you're swallowing. Drinking another, 500 milliliters of water or a liter of water a day really is not. It's a drop in the bucket.
Prune
juice is more on the fiber angle. Mm-hmm. So water, going back to fluids in general, unless you are dehydrated, fluid intake has not been proven to benefit constipation.
And what about fiber now?
So fiber likely does improve constipation. There are two main types of fiber. There's what we call soluble fiber and insoluble fiber. Insoluble fiber does not dissolve in fluids, and where soluble fiber does, that's the general way of breaking them down. And this is found really in various types of foods, including obviously lettuce and vegetables and various fruits, and also whole grains like brown rice or whole wheat bread. Fiber does seem to improve symptoms in constipation, but it's really more the soluble fiber rather than the insoluble fiber that does. So rather than sprinkling some bran on your yogurt in the morning, you'd be better off having some whole wheat bread or brown rice or a cooked type vegetable would be, I think, a better solution.
And where do the prunes fall in? And the prune juice?
So prunes are probably, raw prunes would be an insoluble fiber that, it's not that those fibers aren't good, but they tend to cause more bloating and other types of symptoms mm-hmm. that could cause a little bit of discomfort. So they may be effective, they just may have some more side effects associated with taking some of those types of fiber.
Okay.
The other thing is there's supplements. So there's natural, another way of subdividing is there's natural fiber and there's supplemental fiber. Supplemental fiber, obviously, what you buy at the drugstore or supermarket. And within that, there's a subcategorization of supplemental fibers. There is synthetic fibers, meaning it's not found in nature. It's made literally in a pharmaceutical plant versus some of the natural fibers. The synthetic ones, although I don't own any stock in them, I tend to recommend them because they're not fermentable, meaning the bacteria in the gut don't eat synthetic fibers, and therefore they're less prone to cause bloating. And an example there would be something like Citracil, which is calcium polycarbophil.
And do people get hooked on laxatives?
So this is another one of the great misconceptions in American medical schools and American medical practice. Laxatives are safe for long-term use, as far as we could tell. Do people get hooked on them? Possibly. Is it a problem? Probably not. And I'll give you the story. I was at a meeting, and I ran into one of the world's constipation experts. And what do two gastroenterologists talk about at a meeting like that? We talk about constipation. I said, what do you use to treat constipation? And he said, well, I use a lot of stimulant laxatives. I said, you do? I said, I couldn't believe it. I was taught in medical school that you couldn't use stimulant laxatives long term. And I'm sure all your residents in the family medicine program are taught that as well. He said, where's the evidence that you can't use them? And I said, I just thought it was. He said, that's all mm-hmm. speculation and hearsay. He pointed me to one of the great articles in the GI literature called Myths and Misconceptions of Constipation. It's published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology, probably about 2007 or so, or six. It dispels the notion that stimulant laxatives are unsafe for chronic use. It dispels the notion that water intake uh-huh. will improve your bowel function. It also dispels the notion that increasing your physical activity, unless you're completely sedentary, it's great for you. By all means, do it, but it probably won't improve your bowel function.
So let's talk about laxative 101. We only have about a minute or two, but give us a short, you know, crash course in laxative 101. What do our listeners need to know about laxatives?
And that study just came out about Miralax maybe not being safe for kids, and we use it all the time.
Right.
So
two main types of laxatives, stimulant laxatives and osmotic laxatives. Stimulant laxatives speed the gut up. There are various drugs in this category, including Exalax and Bisacodyl, Dulcolax, et cetera. Osmotic laxatives do not speed the gut up directly, but they stick inside the bowel. Picture you have a garden hose. They stick on the inside of the garden hose, and it causes almost a tidal wave effect to flush some of the bowel, flush things forward. So the Crash Course 101, which do you prefer taking? They're both safe and effective. The osmotic laxatives include things like Miralax, which is best if taken every day, not good if taken just once in a blue moon, milk of magnesia, and various other supplements. I think it's really a personal preference. If chronically constipated individuals, I would lean more towards a Miralax. I know there are some data suggesting possibly in kids it's not safe. Again, I'll say I'm not a pediatric gastroenterologist, so I don't take responsibility for any of that. But if chronic constipation, needing something every day, I probably would go more with a Miralax. Very safe otherwise, not absorbed into the bloodstream. A once in a blue moon type thing, I would go with more of a stimulant laxative.
Wow. What's your take-home message? If listeners get one thing to walk away with, what do you think is the most important thing for people to know?
Constipation is incredibly common. Generally, it's not a sign of some dangerous underlying condition. Usually, it can be treated very effectively. Whether or not to seek medical care is really based on whether there are concerning associated symptoms and how big a deal it is. But if there are not any warning, you know, any alarm symptoms, and if you know, you're doing relatively well, you may not need to do anything for it.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Dorn, for being with us today. We've been talking with Dr. Spencer Dorn, Vice Chief of Gastroenterology at UNC's Center for Functional GI and Motility Disorders, about constipation, causes, prevention, and treatment. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we'll spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Norrie, to read us our very first House Call question today about diabetes.
My husband has diabetes and is significantly overweight. His physician described ways of losing weight and trying to eat better. Regardless, his physician encouraged my husband to stay on his medications. My husband has in fact lost weight and didn't change his medications. His blood sugar is now much better due to the different foods he's been eating. He's not even exercising like he should. How does this happen?
Well, I don't know how it happens that he's not exercising like he should. That's a problem. But
it's good that his blood sugar is better and that he has lost some weight, and that may be related to the changes in his diet that you describe.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because weight loss really can help blood sugar get under better control. exercise can help blood sugar get under better control, but so can choosing better food choices because we have this glycemic index. Certain foods really make your blood sugars have great swings, and obviously some simple sugars, but other things can do it, like juices and things that can just kind of keep it even keel. Things like oats can be very even keel.
Right, and the medications, of course, are a part of that too. So sometimes it's not just one step that contributes to better sugar control of the body, but it's all of those things: weight loss, the medications, exercise, food choices, and probably some encouragement from his wife. Sounds like you're involved in his overall care, and that's good.
Or a son. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My doctor wanted an MRI of the back of my head because of an unusual numbness in my legs. When I went for the MRI, it was the most frightening experience of my life. After 40 minutes, I had to stop because I was just too anxious. They said they could give me medicine to make me sleepy, but that scares me even more. Do I really need this test?
What a really important question and experience, and you are not alone. We have so many patients that get scared about MRIs, and I've had one before, and it wasn't easy.
I've never had one, but I have had many patients who've struggled with this, of that just sort of feeling of anxiety and panic from being closed in. And some people would like a sedating medication, something that would sort of relax the nerves to help them go through that process.
And unfortunately for you, you don't want to have that sedating medicine, so that leaves options a little bit more limited. There are what's called open MRIs and machines that don't have that kind of that donut hole that you go in and you're really enclosed. But those machines are very kind of – they're not so frequent, and they're harder to find, and they could be more expensive, and you may have to get a doctor who's really willing to find one, and you may travel, so it may not be the best solution.
But the question of, do you really need the test, that is a conversation to have with your doctor. Some doctors might order it just to protect themselves or because they think you want it, even though maybe they think you probably don't need it. In a lot of cases, it's not necessary. It's possible under shared decision making to watch it a little bit longer or explore other options before jumping to the MRI or to get another kind of imaging test. So I would have that conversation with your doctor.
Yeah, and you may have to say we have to operate with imperfect evidence. Maybe you get a CAT scan rather than an MRI or some other procedure that you can do that may not be the perfect desired one, but maybe good enough. Thanks so much for a great question. Erica, what's our next house call?
I've recently seen Blue Cross Blue Shield publish the cost of common procedures, and it seems there's a huge variation in the cost of a procedure done in an academic medical center versus a non-academic center. Why are these costs so different?
Well, this would make for a good entire show because it's complicated for sure. And striking that there would be such differences to charges to patients for an operation here or there or a test done here or there. Some of it has to do with negotiating contracts for lab services or for certain elements of staffing or certain equipment. Some of it has to do with charging for facility fees that might be different in an academic institution. There are surely other elements that I don't understand.
Well, sometimes academic medical centers will have cost of training built into sometimes the overall cost, and that can go also into what we call these facility fees for using the facility. So it's highly complicated, just like you say, Christine. I'm not sure one can compare it just in terms of academic versus non-academic, because even within the private practice, there can be substantial variation. But I do think we're going to need to pay more attention, all of us as providers, as health systems, to the cost of treatments and be able to compare and shop and ask the questions. This is a good start.
That's right.
What's our very last house call, Erica?
I have what my doctor calls vestibular migraines for 20 years. I've been doing great over the last 5 years, but the migraines have started to come back more frequently. I'm seeing a new doctor, and she wants me to have all the testing that I've had done 2 or 3 times before again, and an MRI of my brain. These tests are so expensive. I'd really like to know your thoughts.
Well, we don't have a lot of time, but my thoughts real quickly. If you've had it 2 or 3 times over a period of time, and it's the same symptoms, I mean, vestibular migraines are pretty common, and the workup, if they're ruled out the bad things, you probably have vestibular migraine. If it looks, seems, and acts like it, that's probably what it is.
And over 20 years, if it hasn't changed or gotten worse and you've already had that done, I completely agree. It is unnecessary for you to get that done again. I would talk to the doctor and make sure you understand from them why is it they would even want to repeat all that element. And then focus on treating the vestibular migraines, which is a treatment that's often very similar to other types of migraines.
And those vestibular ones are the ones that cause you to have dizziness is one of the major symptoms.
Okay.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls for today. And we want to thank you all for joining us for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. And you can send your questions to us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Spencer Dorn. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.